Legacy of Truth. We shall study Mark 12:18 to 13:37, at 63 verses altogether. As the overview indicates, this part of Mark has been divided into two sections. The first one, Christ deals with traditions, and in the second one, he gives predictions in the famous prophecy of the end times. There are five sections to the first part of Mark 12:18 to 44. Here again, Jesus Christ encounters the enemies who are trying by ridicule and other means to reduce the popularity in the eyes of the people of Jesus Christ as the Messiah. This time the Sadducees come to him. They say there is no resurrection, no angel, no spirit. They ask him. They make up a story, or perhaps this might have been in a rare case, an actual occurrence. The law of Moses stipulated that if a couple were childless, the next of kin should marry the widow, and the resultant son would be the heir of the deceased. In this story, there were seven brothers. Each of them, in succession, married the same woman without a seed. Last of all, the seventh brother died, and the great question is, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife shall she be of them? For the seven had her to wife. Now, what was the point of this story and this question by people who, according to verse 18, don't believe in a resurrection? Well, of course, this kind of hypothetical tale was reducing the resurrection to an absurdity. These people didn't believe in a resurrection, so why ask a question about the resurrection? And the reason why they asked it was to make a fool of Christ. Christ met them head on. You do err because you don't know the scriptures nor the power of God. Because in the resurrection they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of heaven. We are told extremely little about the conditions in the new earth. And here Jesus tells us that there will be neither marrying nor giving in marriage, but life will be lived as it is among angels, whatever that means. But having made that statement, he moves to the next point. But as touching the dead, that they rise, you have not read what Moses said, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is therefore the God of the living. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will one day then live. In this you greatly err. Answers like that silenced the Sadducees, as he had already silenced the Pharisees on more than one occasion. As the people were heckling Jesus Christ, a scribe came to him with a question which they considered very important. What is the first commandment of all? And Jesus answered from the Old Testament, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Love the Lord with your whole heart, your neighbor as yourself. Second is like unto it. There is no other commandment. And the scribe said unto him, Master, thou hast well said. And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly, he said unto him, Thou art not far from the kingdom of God. After that, no one dared to ask him any questions. So Jesus Christ, by his biblical adroitness, silence the caviling of Pharisees, Herodians, Sadducees, and scribes. But his critics still don't give him a moment's respite. Somebody else came to him, verse 35 of Mark 12. How say the scribes that Christ is the son of David, when David calls him Lord? Whose son is he? If David calls him Lord, then is he David's son? What Christ is trying to demonstrate is that the Messiah, according to the scriptures, is both the son of David as a human being and the God of David as a divine being. So this kind of clever caviling does not prove the Bible wrong, but reveals the shallowness and ignorance of the readers of the Bible. In part number 4 of this section, Jesus Christ spoke against the scribes. They have special uniform. They love salutations. They love important seats in the synagogues and the uppermost places in banquets. And yet, they can devour the houses of widows. Slowly eat up their inheritance, and pretending to be very pious, charging high fees, they make long prayers. While he deals with Sadducees, with scribes, with various critics, pointing them to the scriptures as the solution to their quandaries, Jesus Christ never fails to honor the trusting poor. And at this juncture, as he was in the temple, and there were many ostentatiously wealthy people giving their large offerings to the temple treasurers, a certain poor widow woman cast in 2 mites, which make a farthing. And Jesus pointed out this poor widow with her almost insignificant gift and declared that she had given more than the rest of them, because through the 2,000 years that have followed, her example of faithfulness in doing what she was able to do has influenced untold multitudes to give to the Lord as they are able. And these little gifts, multiplied a million times, have amounted to much more than a few large gifts that no one can match. In the second section of this lesson, Jesus Christ deals with the future. He went out of the temple to the Mount of Olives, and there with his disciples looked at the beautiful city, the beautiful temple. And somebody asked him, "What about these stones?" And Jesus replied that the day would come when there would not be left a stone upon another. All would be cast down. Then the disciples asked him another question. "Tell us, when shall these things be? That is, when will the temple be destroyed and its great stones overthrown? When shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming, that is, of the end of the world?" And Jesus answered them, verse 5. And his answer is very significant. He mingles the description of the fall of Jerusalem and the second coming of Christ. He deals with both episodes together. First of all, he warns them against deception, false Christs, false prophets. Then he calls upon them to take heed to themselves, verse 9, because they are to suffer persecution before synagogues and temples and councils and rulers because of the gospel. But the gospel shall first be preached among all nations. Even though God's people are to be delivered up, to be persecuted, the gospel is to triumph. Even though brother will betray brother, and father, son, parents against the children, you'll be hated, yet the end shall come. And he that endures to the end, the same shall be saved. In verse 14, he takes up one of the predictions made by Daniel, the abomination of desolation, spoken by Daniel the prophet. He encourages all who read it to understand. Read it, understand, and let him act. Flee out of Jerusalem, when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, and look for God's protection, when in the ultimate fulfillment of the abomination of desolation, many of the saints shall be tried. These tribulations, verse 20, will be cut short for the elect's sake. Again, Christ repeats the warning that they beware of false Christs and false prophets. Verses 21 and 22, and take heed, because I have told you beforehand. The Lord then gave them some cosmic signs. Sun shall be darkened, moon shall not give her light, stars shall fall from heaven. The powers of heaven shall be shaken. Then the Son of Man will come, send his angels to gather from one end of the earth to the other his elect to be saved in his kingdom. The final part of this appeal was that although I don't know exactly when the end will come, Jesus says, no one knows, not the Son, not the angels, but my Father. Although no one knows precisely when the end shall be, trust, rejoice, watch, for he will come suddenly. Then he adds the encouraging word, blessed, empowered to fulfill function, are those who watch. The Lord would turn his people away from thinking about trivia, about complicated situations hypothetically occurring in the New Age, about the relative importance of one commandment above another, about the difficulties of certain Christological passages in the Scriptures, about the attempts to get honor and glory from men. He would turn their minds away from these things to the eternal realities of the new kingdom whose coming he is certain, not far distant.